Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for MacBreak Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is MacBreak Weekly, episode 192 for April 27th, 2010.
Raid!
MacBreak Weekly is brought to you by GoToTraining. Improve learning, participation, and access to training programs, and save a bunch with GoToTraining. For a free trial, visit GoToTraining.com. And by Drobo, the original S, Pro, and the new Drobo Elite, offering expandable storage products for individuals, small businesses, and creative teams. For more information and instant rebates, visit Drobo.com/MacBreak. And by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. It's time for MacBreak Weekly, the stolen iPhone edition. And joining us, we've got, I think, finally, the definitive panel to talk about this and all the Mac news this week. Starting in the upper left corner of the block, Mr. Alex Lindsay, who is in Zimbabwe today but couldn't miss this episode.
We thought that there was going to be no news. It turned out that there was. But yeah, I'm here in Harare, Zimbabwe, which the news got here probably almost as fast as it got there.
A little bit of news. Because actually the big breaking story we knew about happened on Friday. We didn't know about it till Monday. But we'll get to that in a second. And next in the rotation, Andy Yanako from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth. Are you still chewing? Hey, I'm not hearing you, Andy. You're muted. Hello.
There you go.
There he is.
I muted my hardware mic, but apparently Skype decided that, no, he's probably not going to say anything. Silly.
We'll keep it muted.
Let's just keep him
muted. He'll keep it muted. It's good to have you, Andy. Thank you for joining
us. Good to be here, as always.
Good to have you. Now, we thought we really ought to get some expertise in the picture here today. Not that we aren't an expert panel, but wouldn't it be nice? We've often thought this. Wouldn't it be nice to have an attorney, an actual practicing attorney, on the panel?
Unfortunately, though, you're invalidating this entire discussion about this iPhone thing, because if you have actual legal experts,
what are we going to talk about?
Legal opinions. Right. I mean, sorry, because you're supposed to just have someone who has like an uncle who has an attorney who's an attorney who said, "Hey, you know what? California statute number A4THX1138 clearly states."
Well, Denise Hell knows better. She's here. She is from the This Week in Law blog, a practicing attorney, and the author of the Bag and Baggage blog? And
Bag and Baggage, Bag This Week Baggage, in Law podcast here
this
on the
Week
Twit
in Law
Network.
Podcast and Blogarithms on ZDNet.
Yes. Hello. So, and hello, if it makes you feel any better, Andy, I don't actually practice criminal law, so I'm speculating along with the rest of
really?
You.
Really? How disappointing.
you will still be citing like episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation as your citations, though.
I expect that.
That's what I plan to do.
I'll try.
Also with us, John Gruber, who has dropped off. Let's get him. Boy, we're just not having a good start today. I'd have to start the whole thing over. John Gruber is a blogger at daringfireball.net and has been covering this since day one.
Hey, I think I'm back.
He's back. So, John, it's good to have you. John has really been doing a swell job of covering this. Let me ask before we begin, John, a lot of people speculate that you have some magic resources, some sort of inside tunnel to Apple on this matter. Do you?
No, none. Nothing at all. Honestly, armchair lawyering. But I think the big thing is that everybody is looking at this the wrong way. I think right, and starting with Gizmodo themselves and the way they acted, that they're acting like this is a typical leak of information. And that's not what law enforcement is looking at this as.
Well, let's start with Denise, who, despite her protestations, knows a hell of a lot more about this than any of us. let's quickly do a. I'll do quick do a quick recap of. The latest. It started, of course, a couple of weeks ago
when Engadget first showed pictures and then Gizmodo claimed to have possession of the fourth generation iPhone, the provenance of which is somewhat cloudy, but Gizmodo says it was lost by an Apple engineer at a Hofbräu. He was drinking during his birthday. Someone found it, looked for the owner, couldn't find him, so then offered it in sequence to Engadget and Gizmodo. Gizmodo's Nick Denton from Gawker says he paid $5,000 for the phone. Jason Chen did a number of stories on it, including pictures, took it apart. Apple wrote a letter saying, "I want it. We want it back." Gizmodo apparently gave it back. Then the newest news, Friday, detectives from React, which is a high-tech law enforcement team that is composed of a number of different agencies in the Silicon Valley, about 8:30 at night, raided Jason Chen's home. Jason and his wife came home to find law enforcement in there. They said they'd been there for a couple of hours. He showed him a letter that Gawker's COO and counsel, chief counsel, had given him saying that he was covered by the Shield laws. The detective confiscated that, along with four computers, his business cards, not sure why his business cards, his iPad, a lot of material from his house they've taken off with material. Gawker says, it still says, we're protected by Shield laws. Big debate, of course, on the internet over the, when this news came out, by the way, it didn't come out till Monday, over A, whether, you know, a crime was committed by Gizmodo. The detectives say, from the San Mateo Police Force, say that they are not investigating or they are not accusing Jason or Gizmodo of any criminal act. They're investigating. All they're doing is investigating. Is that are those the facts, Denise, pretty much?
Yeah, pretty good there, Leo.
Did my best.
The React Rapid Enforcement Allied Computer Team, I almost expect Kip from Knight Rider to be pulling up to Jason's house.
No kidding.
With these guys. One little detail that I think is kind of an interesting and important one is I don't think the letter that you're referring to that Gizmodo published on its blog, their response to the search warrant, was after the fact.
He had an email from...
Right. Which I think is really interesting because somehow Gawker had notice that this was going down. You know, when do the police ever give you notice that they're going to search your home with a criminal search warrant?
Does it seem unusually proactive? I mean, if I were the chief counsel, I might, knowing that the Shield laws are... By the way, the Shield laws say, do they not, that you should have a written letter saying I'm protected by the Shield laws in your possession?
I don't think that matters.
I actually don't know that off the top.
I read that in... I was looking at the codes, and I think it's the California code. And I believe it said something to the effect of, upon written notice, they're supposed to withdraw.
There's something we need to parse here, though, because the Shield law is getting confused here.
There's two laws.
Right. The other law is the law that governs issuing a search warrant for whatever may be in your home. And that's the one that's actually at issue here. There is an exception to that law that says that if you're going to go after a warrant, it cannot be under the circumstances and it cannot be for the items specified in the Shield law. So the Shield law is brought in indirectly. The Shield law comes up in the Valerie Plame Judith Miller kind of circumstance, right?
So that's the case where Judith Miller, New York Times journalist, knew the identity of Valerie Plame, or actually had revealed the identity of Valerie Plame.
Right, covert CIA agent.
Refusing to reveal her sources and went to prison for that.
Right. She was held in contempt for not revealing her sources, and that's typically what happens, and that's what... Shield laws are supposed to guard against. So they're part of the evidence code. They govern what evidence can come in at trial. What we're talking now about is part of the penal code that governs when a search warrant can issue. And I don't see any exception to this part of the penal code that says, oh, if you're investigating a crime involving the journalist, then it's okay to go ahead and issue the warrant anyway.
That's where the debate comes down. We didn't see the affidavit that prompted the warrant, but a judge did issue the warrant. It was a search warrant that was being executed. Presumably the judge knows the law, and So there's two possible reasons the judge might have issued that warrant. One, because she didn't feel that Jason Chen was a journalist or that his place of residence didn't reflect, wasn't a journalistic place of business, right? That would be one exception.
Mm-hmm.
The other would be what, that there are some limited criminal activities that can be going on there.
Well, but see, my area of confusion is that, I mean, I'm a journalist, but if I steal a car, that doesn't mean that they can't enter my residence and find out how I stole that car.
Well, what about Denise? Is that the case? By the way, let's assume you're in California, because the laws are different in every state.
I'm sorry, just to qualify, every time I look at the papers that have been filed and the arguments about it, they're about the idea of a journalist's right not to divulge a source for a news story. My area of confusion is that it seems to me as though this is possible. They're not trying to get him to give up his source, but they're trying to figure out where you paid $5,000 for property that may or may not have been stolen. We want to basically investigate you on the transfer of that stolen property. So that's where I'm confused.
Well, also, he's not.
Wait, hold on. I want the attorney to answer.
Sure. So you're absolutely right that what they're engaged in is a criminal investigation here. They're not engaged in trying to make Jason or anybody else divulge their sources in court, which is what the Shield Law applies to. Okay. But the question then becomes, well, how can you go about that criminal investigation? Well, you can issue search warrants, or can you? Because here there is an exception that specifically says if what you're going after with your warrant is the materials used by a journalist in connection with their story, then forget about it. You can't get that warrant.
The reason is it's an umbrella protection because mm-hmm. if you do, as the police did, confiscate everything, other sources can be revealed, right? So this is a very overreaching. These Shield Laws are very broad, but it's to protect. In other words, it doesn't mean he can't be prosecuted. It doesn't mean there's not a way to right. do this, but it has to be done in a specific way because he's a working journalist. Is that correct, Denise?
Yeah, that pretty much captures it. There are different criminal charges that they are investigating. There in California, we have criminal consequences for misappropriating trade secrets, which I haven't seen a whole lot of people discuss yet in connection with this case and what liability might attach to Gizmodo/Gawker under that provision. I have seen a lot of discussion about receiving stolen goods and how that might be something that they're being investigated for.
But does that change the fact that their ability to do a broad search and seizure?
Does it change the fact?
They could do this, execute this kind of search warrant? It seems to me that that's prohibited by the Shield Law, except for the federal law allows it in child pornography and terrorism.
I don't think even Gizmodo went that far here.
Right. That's my question, and I have a couple of things that I worry about. One is that the judge decided, oh, they're online; they're not a journalist. But there's California case law that says that's not the case. In fact, right. it was an Apple case, which you wrote about in your Bag and Baggage blog,
right?
And then, or that there's the other thing that maybe they're somehow let off the hook because it's a criminal investigation,
right?
The EFF does not believe that's the case. The EFF wrote and Wired republished this opinion that mm-hmm. Jennifer Granick said, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I put out on Twitter last night, you know, if any criminal lawyers out there who are looking at this know of any exception to this provision that says you can't get a warrant, let us know, you know, let's start talking about that. And I haven't gotten any answers back about that. The most I've seen on this is some arguments that were asserted by Apple in the case you just mentioned, Leo, which was against Jason O'Grady and some other online journalists concerning the Asteroid device.
Right.
And there was a leak about that. Apple contended that there was criminal conduct there for violation of trade secrets and got the trial court to buy into that. So the trial court refused to grant a protective order under the Shield Law there on this theory that, okay, well, the Shield Law wouldn't apply
because
if there are criminal acts going on. But I haven't delved into Apple's briefing there. It's all there on the EFF site if anyone is inclined to do that and see what arguments they made, if they actually have authority to back that up. I haven't seen that authority yet in this discussion, and I would like to. Until I do, as I read the statutes, I don't see any exception. I see that if you're going to get a warrant, you need to comply with the warrant provision, and these things are carved out of it.
So I mean, I think that's okay. So that's the legal, and apparently, according to TechCrunch, the San Mateo DA detectives have held are pausing. That's the word that was used in their investigation to see if they in fact have the right to this evidence. Would it jeopardize the case if in fact that was an illegal warrant? I mean, would that jeopardize
the criminal investigation?
If they decided to do a criminal investigation, wouldn't that throw everything out?
If you obtain evidence using an illegal warrant, that evidence can't be used.
So they're saying we're not going to look at anything. We're going to pause the investigation. We're going to put this aside. This is what TechCrunch says. Mm-hmm. We're going to put it we're going to put it aside, but we're going to take our time. It may take a few days. If I were Jason, I'd be a little upset.
Go ahead.
So I just wanted to get that kind of legal groundwork out of the way because there's been a lot of discussion on the web about whether it's different because it committed a crime or whether he committed a crime and all that stuff. And that seems to really be moot.
They haven't even been charged with anything.
Nobody's charged with anything. It's just an investigation. So, John, go ahead.
Well, I think there's two possibilities. There's the possibility, you know, to start off with, what are they investigating? I mean, clearly they are investigating what they think may be a felony, right?
Right.
I mean,
says felony on the search warrant.
Right. I mean, they don't break into people's houses, you know, just goofing around.
Just because somebody lost a phone wouldn't be any reason to break into somebody's house.
Right. So possibility A is that the felony that they're investigating is specifically and only about the guy or guys who found the phone and gave it over to Gizmodo. That's who they're investigating for a felony. And if that's the case, then I think clearly, you know, what they did to Jason Chen was absolutely, you know, it was both wrong and you know, almost certainly illegal. That you can't, that's exactly what shield laws are about. You can't issue a warrant against a journalist while investigating a crime like that. But I think the other possibility is that the felony they're talking about is the purchase of stolen property. That is, that Jason Chen is the target or suspect or whatever you want to say of the investigation and Gawker Media, you know, his employer. And in that case, I don't think that the shield laws are going to be much help. Now, it is interesting, exactly as Denise pointed out, I do think that the letter of the California law, that the actual plain reading of it, does seem to suggest that they, you know, you could read it and say they can't issue a warrant against a journalist, period. Even if the journalist, you know, no matter what they think, even if the journalist himself is the target of the investigation. That, as far as I can tell, and I've done a little bit of research and I've seen some posts from actual lawyers and a law professor somewhere, you know, who looked at it, that doesn't seem to have been tested in case law, that provision. It doesn't seem like that's actually, you know, that there's any case law deciding what that means.
It looked like the law said you need to, instead of a search warrant, issue a subpoena so that there can be an argument about just what is appropriate in this investigation and what is protected so that other sources aren't revealed in kind of a fishing expedition.
But I think I would be very, very surprised if a judge were to rule that this shield law means that a working journalist cannot have a warrant issued against them no matter what they themselves are accused of doing.
I don't know. It seems reasonable to me. It provides a way to investigate that is protecting the journalist's sources.
Well, the thing is that we're saying that we're protecting their sources, but we have to remember they already divulged the source. I mean,
you can't apply the law. I mean, I guess you can apply the law selectively, but a judge can. But it seems to me if you're going to have a shield law, it's going to protect them whether or not you believe they've revealed everything or, you know, that there's nothing to hide here. We don't know what other sources are there. We don't know what other stories Jason was covering. All of those things are protected. The point of this is you have to bend over backwards to have a free press. And what happens, the chilling effect is if a law enforcement could say, oh no, Leo, we think you stole a car, so we're going to come in and take all your stuff because they don't like something else I said. That's, you know, that's where you kind of, that's why these laws exist. Is it not? I mean, isn't that the point, Denise?
Yeah, but what if they have really good probable cause that you actually stole a car?
I don't know. Does that change it? In your reading,
I don't think it's ever been tested.
Uh-huh. We're not talking about that. How does stealing a car have anything to do with doing journalism?
Well,
you know,
right. So why would they steal my computer? So maybe stealing a car is a bad thing. Let's say I'm engaged in blackmail, and I'm a working journalist, and they're investigating the blackmail, but they take all my stuff. And in the process of taking the stuff, they happen to find material about sources that they were curious about in a Valerie Plame-like case. Mm-hmm. I think that's my sense of what these laws are about. Go ahead, Andy.
I'm sorry. All I was going to say is to the issue of stealing a car, if I'm an auto journalist, I can find a source who has access to the new Pontiac whatever and give me information about it. I can't bust into like a test track, steal it,
right.
Take it apart in my garage. And then write about it and expect that, well, I returned the car, and so everything should be cool.
No, and nobody's saying they shouldn't be prosecuted criminally if a crime was committed. That's not what's going on here.
All I'll say, I mean, no. I've been very silent because I know nothing about the law, and I should make sure. And that's the sort of thing where professionally I consult people who can advise me about the law.
That's why we get to Nissan.
And also, right, exactly. That's really the only thing that I'm still fascinated about, that there seems to be two different areas to this case. The area in which they might have had property that did not belong to them, and then so that by one reading of the law, that might be stolen property. And then the area in which they took what might be construed as a trade secret, and published it. So that's why I'm you can tell me I'm listening closely, because I'm like, when you cut to me accidentally, I'm like looking like this because I'm
well, I agree. I really want to learn. And this is why people get into the law, by the way. This is a fascinating intellectual question, yeah. But it has some.
Really? Criminal procedure was always one of my favorite classes in law school, even though I never practiced it.
It's fun. But at least you, Andy, and I, and John and Alex have a dog in this hunt, because we are online journalists. And if the judge's opinion was, well, Jason Chen's not a journalist, then that is worrying. And it's important to us as journalists that shield laws are upheld, I believe, because that protects the practice of journalism. Even if it makes it a little harder to prosecute somebody who stole a phone, if that's what happened here. It doesn't let them off the hook. Nobody's suggesting that there shouldn't be a criminal procedure here. It's just that instead of the search warrant, it should have been a subpoena. Is that right?
I do understand. I totally understand that the plain reading of the law of that California statute could be interpreted that way. I don't think that when this is finished, that's the way it's going to be ruled. Because it's not about finding criminal actions of Gizmodo's sources, I believe. I believe this is about a case that they're building against Gizmodo's and Gizmodo's editors and Jason Chen.
And presumably in the affidavit to the judge, which was never released, they would have said that to the judge, and the judge would have then said, oh, well, in that case...
That's how I believe that when we find out the details, I believe that is what we're going to find out.
And I think that the payment is going to be a key piece of this. It's the actual payment for a piece of stolen goods. I think that the actual transaction a lot of times creates, opens up a can of worms. I'm not the lawyer, but I think
that comes up under the trade secret laws too, but... Again, this case is so interesting and unique because what the trade secret laws are trying to prevent is you going to the individual, what was his name, Mr. Gray, in the bar, who had the prototype, and bribing him to turn it over, right? Or somebody else at Apple. But here we have the whole intervening layer of it having been lost and recovered, and then the person who got paid was not an Apple employee who had those trade secrets to begin with.
We should point out that we don't really know any of this. This is Gizmodo's story.
Right.
And it's only if you believe everything Gizmodo said and perhaps, it's very possible that React did some investigation and found out that Gizmodo, went to Mr. Gray, we'll just call him Mr. Gray for now, and said, we would like this phone. And Mr. Gray, as an Apple employee, sold it to them. Now, if that's the case, then there is absolutely, trade secret violation. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on there.
That doesn't seem to be the case, though.
It does not seem to be the case.
We don't know, though, do we?
Well,
couple of points, Leo. You keep saying, well, shouldn't a subpoena have been issued? And I think we're confusing apples and oranges there.
Oh, okay.
A search warrant is what you want to have in hand when you're an officer, police
to go in. You can't
enforcement person. Yes,
yeah.
to seize and obtain evidence. A subpoena is something that anybody can have issued in a civil case, and that's how typically the Shield Law is triggered.
Oh, I see.
Information is subpoenaed, okay. And so that's why the Code of Civil Procedure, where the Shield Law appears, talks about
civil, yeah,
penis. Yes, it's brought into the penal code through this warrant.
So what would have been the how would the police have then properly done this? How can police investigating a crime get information from a journalist's house?
I don't know under this provision that they can get the items that are specifically discussed there. Now, you know, if they're going after things that do not relate to the journalist's function,
right,
in doing the story and are not their materials related to that, but do relate to the crime in some way, then that might be the path they could take.
A stolen car in the backyard, they can take that. They can look for that.
Right.
They can't, though, just say, well, you got a stolen car, but let's take all your computers,
right,
too.
So here the fourth generation iPhone, say, if that had still been.
If they found that, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, although it was part of the material that related to the story, it was not, you know, notes and preparation and stuff. I think that a distinction might be drawn there. But what I'm not seeing, as I said before, is an exception to this provision that says, no, you cannot get a warrant in these circumstances. Now, while we've been on the call, an undisclosed friend on Skype who's listening to the show sent in a copy of an old 1975 California decision that went through this kind of analysis. It's called Rosado v. Superior Court of Fresno. If people want to look that up on Google Scholar Legal, that is where it's residing, or one copy of it. And at page 217 of that decision, it gets into a discussion where the court apparently went through this and looked at the statute and decided, well, yeah, we don't see a whole lot of guidance here, but we're going to interpret this as not triggering the Shield Law. So you could see that courts have struggled with this. Now, this is an old case, and, you know, as I said, it would be interesting to go through Apple's briefing in connection with the Apple versus Doe's case and see if they even raised this, or, you know, what other sort of support they had for this argument that, oh, if there's criminal proceedings involved, then, you know, we can ignore this whole Shield Law annoyance. But as I said, until I see a lot more authority about taking the exception out of play, the exception for getting a warrant, I think it applies.
But this might bolster John's argument that, well, there was a crime committed here, so that then all bets are off. Nobody's been charged with a crime. The police say we're just investigating. But they could say to the judge in asking for the search warrant, well, what we're doing is investigating Jason Chen, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the judge, that doesn't have to be revealed just because the police, that's what the police say publicly. So what is, okay. All right. I think we've gone as far as we're going to be able to go. And I hope that at some point we will get some clarification from somebody. I guess you won't till it goes to court. Do you think, now here's the other thing that people are assuming, is that Apple, because Apple serves on an advisory board for this React team, Apple actually prompted this investigation. The detective in San Mateo says, well, yeah, Apple called and said there was some stolen property. How much did Apple have to do with this? Andy, what do you think?
Unknown and unknowable. I'm not even going to guess.
Oh, come on. How about you, Alex? You want to guess?
I'm sure that they called and I'm sure that they were upset.
I'm certain that they would not have done anything to jeopardize any present or future prosecution of anybody who may or may not have committed a crime against Apple.
They would be intelligent and certainly wouldn't pull strings.
I'm just saying, for me to speculate would be nothing but 100% like speculation. I don't have any information about
it. Does it seem like an overreaction to bring this React team? And I mean, somebody said, boy, I hope the next time I lose a phone in a bar, I get the React team on my... I mean, does it seem like... It has to be a trade secret issue, right?
Well, I mean, I think largely it has to be just a, you know, don't push us around issue. It's bad for business if you put it out there that no matter how you get your hands on one of our trade secrets, you can do whatever you want with it, and we will just do nothing about it.
So well, look at it this way.
Go ahead, John.
Imagine that this guy who lost the phone, the guy from Apple, let's say his family lives in, let's say Philadelphia here.
Okay.
And he was visiting in Philadelphia and lost the phone here. And, you know, the police get involved. Would the police have any idea what the police in Philadelphia have any idea of just how special this phone was? And we all know, anybody who's listening to this show knows this was an extraordinary device to, let's assume that that's what happened, that he left it behind in a bar. Would the police here have any idea just how extraordinary that phone is? Probably not. The React Task Force, the whole reason they were commissioned is, you know, and that's exactly what the district attorney in San Mateo said as to why they were called in, is it's their job to assess, you know, unusual situations like this and determine, is this, is this just a phone, like somebody lost a phone, or is this an extraordinary, you know, important million-dollar trade secret to one of the companies in Silicon Valley. I mean, that's exactly what they're for.
I was going to say is that I think that we do have to remember that this is a crime that did occur in the middle of Silicon Valley. The thing is that you are going to have a police department, just like in Hollywood, that is going to be more sensitive to certain things around those issues. You're going to have people very sensitive. There's a lot of companies that are very sensitive about their trade secrets, and what they don't want to see is suddenly a lot of money being thrown around to steal those trade secrets, and the ability for someone to say, well, we're press and we're not, you know, we can do whatever we want. I mean, I think that's a fear that would affect the police department in that specific
area.
That's
a good point. It's a company town. Not in my neighborhood do you do that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I would say it's a little bit more fair to say it's an industry town. I think Hollywood's a perfect
industry town. Yes.
But it's not one company. It's not Apple's town.
Right.
You know, I mean, Apple's obviously a very big fish, you know, but it's, you know, I think Cisco, I think.
Right. Any of those companies would expect this.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's fair. All right. Well, I want to take a break. Denise, if you, we didn't want to take your whole day. If you want to split, you can. If you want to stick around, you can.
I'd love to stick around if I can.
All right.
Thanks.
We appreciate having some actual insight.
Exactly.
That's very valuable. Sure. Before we go much further, though, I do want to mention our friends at Drobo, who have come out with yet another fantastic product. They just keep doing it, and I've got some special deals for you if you want to take advantage of our MacBreak web page, drobo.com/MacBreak. Drobo, of course, the company that created the amazing Drobo storage products a couple of years ago, starting with the original Drobo with 4 disk bays, complete redundancy. You can mix and match drives, lose a drive, no problem. You swap in another drive, boom, rebuilds. You're never without your data and never at risk. You want to expand capacity, take out the smallest drive, put in a bigger one, boom, automatic expansion. The newer Drobo S has 5 bays. That means both more storage and better performance, perfect for creative professionals. I use the original Drobo for backing up my iTunes library and all that stuff because I think there's 4 or 5 terabytes in there. You go up to 16 terabytes, of course, if you put 2 terabyte drives. 8 2 terabyte drives. And 10 if you have it in the Drobo S. The Drobo Pro is the one with 8 bays. That'll give you 16 terabytes. That's for small businesses, creative teams. iSCSI built in. The new Drobo Elite has dual gigabit Ethernet ports. So you can get multiple network connections. I think 16 different users can use it at the same time. Great for editing teams. It's basically a SAN. Small businesses, VMware certified, great for virtualization, the new Drobo FS as well. All of these drives are available at drobo.com/MacBreak, and we have discounts from $75 to $500 off populated systems. Some significant savings. I want you to check it out. drobo.com/MacBreak. I think almost all of us on MacBreak Weekly use Drobos for our own backup solutions. And we have to say, we think you should too. Drobo.com/MacBreak. We thank them so much for their support of MacBreak Weekly and the entire Twit network. So we're agreed Apple has an interest in this. React has an interest in Apple, but they're not Apple's minions. That they're acting on behalf of the tech industry in general and doing exactly what they were formed to do, which is investigate high-tech crimes.
Well, I think the other thing to remember, too, is that district attorneys are, it's a political office. It's, you know, they get elected, they run for election. They tend to, you know, the position tends to draw people who enjoy attention. So, you know, I think the fact that, you know, do you think this case is getting attention? I mean, I would say so. So I think it's, you know, unfortunate for the targets of the investigation. I think the fact that it's going to draw it significant attention only makes it more likely that the district attorney in San Mateo is going to pursue it vigorously.
Makes sense. Sure, of course.
Well, and I think we haven't talked at all about the poor sap who sold it to Gizmodo, because once they get a hold of him, you know, he's going to definitely pay a lot more than the $5,000 he got. Even if he's found not guilty, it's going to be, you know, if they really take him to task.
Is that who they're looking for? Is that what this is really all about, is who found this phone or stole this phone? Is he the guy they're going after, or are they going after Gizmodo too?
I think they're probably going after both. I don't know, but I think that they're probably going after both. But I have to say that there is almost no defense for what he did. And so the thing, there's not a shield law, there's not anything else. Once he sold that, I mean, you know, he's in deep doo doo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the part of the whole thing that really got to me. The idea that, oh, we tried really hard to return it. What else could we do but try to sell this phone for $5,000 to Gizmodo?
We had no choice.
Apple on the way to work.
I think it's interesting, though. He must have known that this something about the Gizmodo story does not smell right.
Something.
Okay. I mean, this mysterious Mr. X who took the phone found the phone and got it to Gizmodo. How did he know what he had? And at what point did he know what he had? The phone was disguised. And even I mean, you fooled me, Andy. You had a 3GS. You put it in a Mophie case. I didn't know it was a 3GS.
Yeah, but realize that the phone that I had was, even if it was outside of the case, it was absolutely indistinguishable from the real thing. It was built to look like, it was a production 3GS, and that's the only reason why I was using it, like, out and about. How this person knew what he had is sort of immaterial. The question is, and this is more of an ethical thing than anything about journalism or about the law, it's about... Who, when they find a phone in a bar, does not think, I will hand it over to the bartender, or I will simply say, I found some guy's phone, here is my phone number, here is my address, here's how you can get in touch with me if someone finds it. You know, I would never even think about handing it over to selling it or doing anything personal with it until every avenue had been exhausted. And all I was about to say is that the only thing that I can say that's similar in my own existence was that I was out taking a walk sometime, and so I guess one of the postal workers outside the post office, this is like long after the place closed, had left his like master keys inside the mailbox after taking his final collection of the day. And so I pounded on the door. No one came by. I pounded to the back door. No one came by. They must have thought that it was just someone who was trying to mail a letter. So the next, I didn't think, well, great. Now I have a free set of master keys to the post office.
You can sell those to Gizmodo.
Exactly. No, I got up my cell phone. I called the local police saying, hi, I've just found a set of master keys. I'm on my way. I can't get them to come out and get them. I'm driving over 1 mile and a half. I'm going to... walk home, get my car, go over to your police station and drop them off. I'm the person who has them, and I'm turning them over immediately.
No, it's clear. Any normal person would have given it to the bartender.
Right. More interesting question if the Gizmodo guy actually had found it himself. That would be more of a ethical quandary. Because you could say, you know what, it's going to take me a half an hour. I'm going to have someone drive me to the police station. And during that 22-minute drive, I'm going to document the hell out of this. Right.
Which would not be illegal.
I'd still return it. I would look at it. That would be very well documented. And then, of course, I would have to have the conversation with my editor saying, find out for me whether or not I've just broken a whole lot of laws, and if I'd break a whole lot more if I actually published any of this information.
Denise, what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say that my husband, who I told this story to this morning, in addition to being convinced that Mr. Gray must have been trying to pick up women in the bar by showing off the new iPhone.
Aha. Mm-hmm. Aha. Now we have a motive.
Trust me, that doesn't work. That totally doesn't
work. Wait a minute. I just saw a stat. Is it 44% of women would date somebody with it just because they had an iPhone or something? I probably
also
would
wondered
not work.
Why, you know, Why go to Gizmodo? Why not go to Apple, who's going to pay you a whole lot more than $5,000 to get this thing back?
No. Apple's going to pay you zero.
Yeah. And if you ask Apple for money, maybe they would say,
Well, that would be extortion, and maybe he was
right. Maybe he
smart
was
enough to figure that one out.
He was pretty smart. He had to know what he had immediately, or he would have slammed it on the bar and said, hey, somebody left his phone here. So I think you're right, Denise. The Apple engineer is saying something publicly. What do you think, John?
I think Apple has a very keen interest in the broad sense of discouraging any sort of bounty market for these sort of devices. And that is why, for example, if somebody who was completely honest, let's just say Andy found this phone instead of this guy, and Andy recognized it and immediately took it to Apple, drove it to Cupertino in the middle of the night, or whatever, the most honest thing you could possibly do with the phone, that there would be no reward. They might say thank you, they might shake your hand, but they're not going to give you a financial reward. I mean, that's just one of many ways that they're going to do whatever they can to discourage either the perception or the actual, you know, justification of a bounty market for these sort of devices.
We don't negotiate with terrorists.
Exactly. I mean, that's just, you know, I mean, that's a, you know, obviously a radical analogy, but it's, you know, it's the same game.
Apple would say, you have to check for your... Go ahead.
We just have no idea how this guy got the phone either. I mean, we can say we found it in the bar, but I've had a camera, you know, a little HV20 taken out of my coat pocket, didn't even feel it. You know, I mean, you know, the thing is that someone could have noticed that he had the phone and pickpocketed him, as far as we know.
Was it wrong for Gizmodo to pay $5,000 for the phone?
I think absolutely.
We have two different issues here. Again, personal ethics and your ethics as a journalist, because as uncomfortable as it is, you do have a responsibility to your readers that if you have information that is of paramount value to readers, or that just simply needs to get out, that doesn't absolve you of any legal problems you're in, but that could be a justification for actually going ahead and publishing.
I remember a judge, when asked if it's in the public interest, he said, "Is the public interested? It's in the public interest."
Right, but in this case, I think that anybody that you would float this by would say, "Well, what will you be telling the public about this phone?" Well, you'll be basically telling them things they already know. You have exactly three data points, none of which are earth-shattering. It just wouldn't, to me, ethics are subjective, they're not universal. To me, that would not have trumped the legal problems and the personal ethical problems of not just simply returning this phone.
Anybody else? John, you think it was wrong for them to write that check?
I do. I think because they took possession of the phone. Honestly, I immediately, as soon as I heard this story, I mean, that's one of the reasons I've been fascinated right from the get-go, is as soon as I heard their story, I mean, effectively to me, Gizmodo published, if this ends up going as I think it's going to, and so far, you know, I've been fairly right, I think they're going to get prosecuted for a felony of knowingly purchasing stolen property.
And that is illegal, and it is a felony if it's over $900.
I don't think that they ever really saw it that way. I think that Gizmodo treated this the way they treat other scoops, you know. And look back at the stuff with Apple, the asteroid case with Jason O'Grady and Think Secret. That was not, number one, that wasn't a criminal case; it was a civil case and trade secret. But one of the reasons it wasn't a criminal case was that they didn't get a unit. They didn't get a prototype unit. They got information. They got, like, you know, emailed. It was, you know, sent over as ones and zeros, these, you know, plans and I think like a keynote deck describing the product. That's information, you know, and that's, you know, that's the way almost all of these scoops, all, you know, that's what everybody just thinks information. It's all scoop, scoop, scoop. What's the phone like? Here's pictures of the phone. Here's what it does. Here's the information. They crossed what I think is a very, very vivid line when they took possession of the phone and paid money for it. So here's a hypothetical, and a whole bunch of Daring Fireball readers have emailed this to me reading about this. It's, you know, I've gotten at least a dozen emails asking more or less this. Here's just a hypothetical scenario. Why didn't Gizmodo, when they were contacted by these sources, why didn't they say, let's go check it out? go look at it, bring your nice SLR. If you want to, even if you pay for access for the scoop, for the information, you know, just for the privilege of meeting you fellows, here's $5,000. Take your photos of the phone that's in their hands. Don't touch it. Just, you know, take all your nice photos, look at it, get their story, and then say to the guys, well, what you guys should do is call this number at Apple, take it to an Apple store, get rid of it. Go back, you know, write up their story, put their big scoop on Gizmodo, and say everything they know. I think that they're in a totally different legal situation if that's what they had done.
Troubled wine.
Never taking. And you can argue then about the ethics, the journalistic ethics of paying for the access. That's right. Just like when you pay for an interview or
Nick Denton says, that's what we do. Gawker's right. A checkbook. We believe in checkbook journalism.
But they should have. I don't think they should have ever taken custody of the phone. And I think I know why they took custody of the phone. I'll tell you that.
Why?
Here's my theory on that. Is because the phone wasn't operating. It didn't, you know, it was. However that happened, whether it was right. Remotely disabled because they knew it was lost or otherwise broken by the guys who found it, it wasn't working. So all they were able to get were what we've seen, these photos of an prototype iPhone that doesn't turn on, which is nowhere near as interesting as an iPhone that does turn on and has the iPhone OS 4.0. With all of the, you know, this front-facing camera, the high-resolution screen, whatever other features are in the new OS that aren't in what we've seen in the beta releases for old iPhones, that's way more interesting. Andy's pointed out that the only thing that we've found out about, we know what it looks like, but the actual technical details that are revealed are stuff that we all sort of knew anyway.
You believe it was that it actually was a fourth generation phone.
Oh, yeah, I think it's very, very close to what they're going to show.
Based on the numbers on the back, I saw in your post.
Yeah, yeah. It said N90 underscore DVT. I knew from other sources that N90 was the internal code name for the next generation iPhone shipping, you know, sometime this summer, I guess. And DVT is design verification test, something like that. But it's very, very close to production.
And that would give this Apple engineer, a reason to have it out in the wild. It was being tested.
Right. So I think Gizmodo wanted the phone, and that reason it took them 6 days after they took the phone from these guys and before they published anything is I think they were trying to figure out some way to re-enable it.
It's a much bigger story, yeah.
Right, and hooking it up to iTunes and calling around and seeing if there was any possible way that they could re-enable the phone.
Does that make them more culpable?
Yeah, I think because they took possession of the phone.
What if they didn't pay for the phone? Does that change it? If Troubled Wine suggests in the chat room, how about if the guy who found it just gave it to them? Does that change it? Does it change the law in California if you don't buy it? I mean, I know it's no longer a felony because it's not worth over $900.
Right, and again, we were talking about the trade secret laws before, which specifically are designed to discourage you from having someone in possession of a trade secret. So someone working
buying
for Apple.
From an engineer, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's all kinds of language in there about how, you know, if you benefit from that in any way, you know, then you're on the hook for liability too. So if you're the person who pays off, and then if you do a big story, then you can't do that. And that's, you know, that's one kind of checkbook journalism that you simply cannot do to appropriate your phrase there, Leo. But here we've got this whole layer that doesn't seem to be dealt with specifically in the trade secret laws about the person who found it and then attempted to just happened to find it, you know, didn't try and
right.
Get it off the guy or anything. And then attempted to capitalize on it. So I think we're in a bit of a gray area here. One thing I was finding interesting as John was talking, he mentioned that this, unlike the O'Grady case, is a criminal investigation. And I think that's a really interesting point because in the O'Grady case, Apple went the civil route, right? They had a civil subpoena issued. They were trying to get at the sources through an Apple versus Doe's case. The Doe's were the people who had leaked the trade secrets, presumably the Apple employees who Apple wanted to identify and get rid of for engaging in such conduct. Here, in that case, Apple got its hat handed to it, right?
Yeah.
It lost that case big time. And we have precedent now on the books about protecting journalists and online journalists in that situation, and about what's permissible under the Stored Communications Act in going after things that are held with an ISP, which was what was involved in that case. They were trying to get at emails that were not locally stored. So here we have Apple now going a completely different route. And I don't mean to, you know, sound too conspiracy theory oriented here, but with Yahoo doing its bit of good journalism on the fact that Yahoo is actually on the steering committee of
Apple
this,
of
this React task force.
Right, right.
You know, Corey, whether Apple looked to the past and said, well, you know, we've gone the civil route before and that didn't go so well for us. Let's sick the React guys on them and see what we can shake down.
Denise, a criminal conviction will improve the position of a civil case later, won't it?
They could still sue.
Yes.
I mean, the thing is that when you once they get a criminal conviction, they can pull a lot. The knives get a lot longer.
Yes.
You know, the thing is that it, when it's all, because then you have that that toe in the ground that you can that you really can push on. You know, from my limited experience working as a in a law firm.
So, you know,
that was
an interesting note. Wozniak went to Wired. Steve Wozniak went to Wired and said that the Apple engineer had not been fired. And then really revealed that an engineer who'd showed Woz an iPad at midnight on iPad ship day was fired. What do we deduce from that? Wired deduced that perhaps the engineer who showed him the iPad had broken an explicit rule, and the engineer who lost the iPhone was just a victim. It was a mistake, and so Apple couldn't fire him. Let me ask you, John, have you heard anything about whether Mr. Gray had been fired?
Mr. Powell.
I know his name. I'm actually saying his...
Mr. Gray. Mr. X, okay.
They call him Mr. Blue.
All right, Mr. Blue, Mr. Gray. No, I, as far as I know, he is still on the job. I can't confirm that.
Right.
But I mean, as far as everybody at Apple seems to know, it's, you know, still in the company directory, et cetera, et cetera.
Huh.
There are many people who are very surprised about that.
Yeah, why?
I mean...
Well, unless Apple determined... And it sounds to me like Apple just said, oh, well, it was... You know, I think maybe he's unlikely to get fired if it was stolen, and there's no evidence that he went around saying, "Hey, I've got the fourth generation iPhone." Then he's a victim. It's as if it was stolen from his office. He's not. He was doing what he was supposed to do, and it was stolen. If he went around saying, "I've got the fourth generation iPhone," maybe he's culpable. If he left it on a bar stool, I'd fire him. I mean, but maybe that's Apple's way of saying, "No, we think it was stolen."
Well, and what also if, even if it was genuinely just left behind, absentmindedly, and in general principle, they would like to say, you know what, for being that careless with something this important, you know, you're done, pack your stuff and get out. What if, though, see, the difference with the Woz thing, which is interesting, and I heard from somebody else, this is like secondhand, but somebody else confirmed that, yeah, that the guy who showed him that the iPad was let go.
Right.
What he was shown, though, was not the Wi-Fi iPad. It was the iPad with 3G.
And there's even a picture of him with the 3G iPad that night.
Right. It was like 12 hours after the debut, and somebody noticed that the iPad that Woz was holding had the black. It's like the original iPhone. It has like an inch and a half black plastic thing at the top. And they're like, whoa, he's got the one that's not coming out until May. You know, so that is, you know, I don't know. I guess he was not authorized to take that out and about or show it publicly, and he did. But now in that case, now you can say whether it's right or wrong that Apple cans a guy for that, but it's the end of the story, right? The interest is, the rule is if you've got that device, the 3G iPad, you've got it for field testing, just like, you know, this Mr. Gray had the phone for field testing. The rule is you can't show it to anyone.
Right.
And this guy broke it, and that's the end of the story. They still had it. It wasn't lost. We're sorry, but we have to let you go. Now, with Mr. Gray, let's say they had just gotten the phone back the next day, right? They'd gotten the phone back. Maybe then he gets fired because the story's over. Maybe Mr. Gray is still on the job because Apple's, the larger interest is Apple's now interested in pursuing the case against Gizmodo as vigorously as they can. And it might be in their interest to keep Mr. Gray as a gainfully employed and very thankful employee of Apple in the meantime.
By the way, I misspoke. While I read the story about Woz in the Wired Epicenter blog, in fact, it was a Gizmodo story. He went to Gizmodo. Oddly enough, Wozniak went to Gizmodo to tell this story.
Hey, guys, here's something breaking, something that went up on the web at 10:43, right before we started to record. Two of my favorite tech law journalists, Declan McCullough and Greg Sandoval at CNET, have an article up now saying it's called Journalist Shield Law May Not Halt iPhone Probe. And I posted the link into the chat room, Leo.
Okay.
It goes through, and it's funny because last night I was looking for Professor Eugene Volokh to weigh in on this. He's a longtime law blogger and very smart thinking about these issues. And they quote him in here. He brought up that 1975 case that we talked about before on the show. And, you know, I haven't read through this thing in great detail yet, but jumping to the punchline at the end, it looks like a California court would still have to break some new ground here in California to find that this exception to the warrant provision wouldn't apply because of the investigation of a crime aspect. So they go through and have some discussion here about how, well, you know, of course it makes sense that if you're investigating a crime, this shouldn't apply. But it looks like a court would still have to jump through some hoops to say, yeah, okay, we agree with that.
That's presumably what the DA is now, you know, inquiring mm-hmm. with their lawyers about. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want to go forward if they can't use that material. In fact, they probably don't want to even look at that material to protect it.
Right.
What would their culpability be? What would their liability be if the judge ruled that, oh no, you shouldn't have done that?
Can Jason sue the
React?
The React? No, they would be immune from.
They're shielded
that.
As well.
Yes, exactly. the government is allowed to make mistakes as they go about their functions, unfortunately. So they would be subject to immunity for
but
that.
But he'd get his stuff back. Let's.
Oh, yeah. And they theoretically followed all the rules that they knew of. They went to a judge. Right. They got the warrant. They went through the due process that was required in that. To the best of their knowledge, to the best of the judge's knowledge, it's not like it doesn't. Right now, it doesn't look like there's any malice specifically. I mean, nothing be manipulated that we know of.
It's a really good article by Greg Sandoval and Declan McCullough.
Right,
well worth reading.
One thing I haven't seen the law enforcement folks come back on. You know, and obviously they're going to be covering their own tracks at this point. But Leo, you mentioned that TechCrunch piece about how they're pausing.
Right.
Seemed to me a pretty glaring thing that the warrant clearly stated they were not to go in and do a night search. And that's exactly what they did, apparently.
No. California statute says that night search is 10 p.m. to 7 a.m.
So they went in before 10 p.m. So they're okay there.
All right.
Yeah, you were saying.
I'm just saying that Declan McCullough and Greg Sandoval they broke the story on Friday that React was doing this. I mean, they were way ahead of this, and they only cited unnamed sources. But I know from Declan McCullough's record over the last 15 years that when he says that there's a criminal investigation, there's a criminal investigation.
They say in that article that Apple has spoken to local police about the incident, and the investigation is believed to be headed by the React Computer Task Force. So they got it right on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys something about why you think they would go after Chen's materials. You know, I mean,
why didn't they go to Gawker's office? You mean?
Well, not just that, but let's presume that Chen is the right person to have the information that they're actually looking for, the source of who this person was who sold the phone. Let's presume that. But let's also think about the way you guys do your own online journalism. Are you storing a whole lot of this stuff locally these days? You know, I mean, and are you also, you know, leaving
it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder to go after Google than it is to
That's the point I'm getting at here.
So maybe we should be storing our stuff in the cloud these days.
Uh-huh.
Well, then, if I started doing that, then I would have to take three times as much time examining every single TOS of every single cloud service that I use, because I'm actually a little bit more comfortable with law enforcement turning my office, because you know exactly, they have to document everything that they took. There's no question as to when they were there and what they got. The idea that maybe a month later I get some sort of email notification saying, oh, by the way, we had a request from law enforcement about a month and a half ago, so of course we handed over everything that was in your Dropbox or everything that was in your box.net and gave them free access. And they've been basically looking at everything you posted there for the past month. I think that's one of the reasons why there's some things I simply do not put on cloud storage of any kind.
That's interesting.
Not only for that, but also because there are times when you have to be able to tell a certain party that, no, I have full control of this information or this document or this device at all times. You can say that maybe someone will break into my house or will break into my safety deposit box and get it, but you can say that there is no point at which someone could access that without my knowledge.
Right. So I guess that begs the question from me to all you Mac aficionados. How do I encrypt my home folder?
You know, I was always told from day one that you write things in a reporter notebook and you file them and you store them and you keep them and you note everything. You write everything down and you yep. file it all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have it on here, but that's people wonder why I have this Clairefontaine notepad. Am I still on? Things are frozen. Okay, good. Sometimes people make fun of me because at a conference or at any place where I'm actually working, I'll have like a Clairefontaine like spiral bound notebook in here, and that's because if you need to prove that you're actually there somewhere and you actually talk to somebody and that this was actually the information that you got from them, it's not 100% fireproof, but. The fact that you can produce, well, here are handwritten notes of everything that I saw and did while I was covering this event or talking to this person. So if he's going to say that later on I made something up, he can say, well, no pages have been inserted. No pages have been changed. The exact same color ink pen for all the notes in front of this and behind this were also in the exact same thing. And there is bleed through from the page in front of it to the page behind it that also say that, yes, we were on the record and you told me this and I wrote it down. So
Denise, it might be the opposite. Yeah. Start buying more of those notebooks and writing things in ink.
the high tech way to do things.
Interesting, but I was always told that. I said the NBC used to tell us that don't put it on your computer. Write it down. For that very reason, you can't. You can't always prove where something came from.
I also wonder. I wonder how frequently this React task force does this sort of thing. I mean, obviously, in the case of something being high profile, being somebody who's a member of the press, this is the first time. But
they must
how often do they do it in cases that are, more like what you think of as, corporate espionage, where you're selling it, for money and not, trying to keep it out of the press. Like if a company calls the React Task Force and says, we have an employee who we suspect is... selling trade secrets to a competitor, here's our evidence, backing this up. How often did they do that? I mean, it seems to me like it was a very, very well, that they knew exactly what they were doing, and the warrant, to my layperson's terms, I don't know about the legal aspects of it, but in terms of what they were looking for was, it was very intelligently written.
Really? It seemed like they cast a pretty broad net. I mean, taking his business cards, taking his iPad, it seemed
taking
like
his airport base station.
Yeah, it seemed like they cast a too broad of a net.
Well, I think the business card, that does seem silly. And it was the first thing. And I my wife, has been to law school, as they say. And, she said it's probably just simply,
her.
It's just simply, a matter of, establishing that, establishing that he worked for Gizmodo. I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, I'm sure there's a reason why they take what they take. But
Like an indignity, though. Like, yeah. Now he needs new business cards.
Yeah.
The whole litany of things taken and the litany of things permitted to be taken under the subpoena is pretty funny. I mean, just classic ancient lawyer legalese about how including but not limited to CD-ROMs and floppies and, you know, what decade are these folks operating in exactly?
It was tapes that I really, or digital tapes. Yeah. You know, it's like, unfortunately, I'm in the wrong room for this, but one of the few objets d'art that I have in my house is this 1.4 gigabyte huge but gorgeous like Winchester disc pack from like 1973, 1974. It's all steel and smoked plastic and orange safety, don't drop this on your toes sort of disc storage. And I just, I don't want ever law enforcement to come into my house and see stuff.
Oh, we got the drive.
I love the fact that it would make me feel better to know that somebody's going to have to figure, going to spend $80,000 figuring out how to mount this on something and get whatever, you know, bank information from 1973 was on this when I bought it at the MIT flea market. That would at least give me some, at least a small amount of comfort in this time of trouble.
All right, we're going to take, go ahead, Denise.
Just talk about insult to injury. They took his iPad.
I know. That's what,
look at his apps that he's downloading. Maybe he has some.
That's what broke my heart.
Stolen property oriented app that he's got.
Leave the guy his iPad. At least he can get some work done, for crying out loud.
He shouldn't be allowed to have an iPad the way he's behaved. And the worst part is, give him a month without Apple products so we can think about what he did.
The worst part is Apple is enforcing this rule that you can only buy two per person. So if he's already bought two, he can't even replace it. The poor guy's got no iPad.
I told this story last week, John, that I got an email after I'd already ordered an iPad. And a couple of days later saying, well, just to make sure everybody can get one, we've canceled your order. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, they did that to me, too. Yeah. I called up and was like, well, can I? I'd already ordered one. And the order they canceled was for two more.
Right.
And they canceled the whole order. And I was like, well, can't I get the one and have it put back in the queue at the same place? And they're like, no, there's no system for that.
The funny thing is, you can walk into a store and get one.
Yeah.
I guess that's what they want you to do. Make sure everybody has access. That's okay. And Jason?
Surely on this side of Jerusalem, none suffer as we suffer.
Actually, Israel has allowed the iPad back in. So that's good news also for those of you headed to Israel. We're going to take a quick break. We're having fun talking about the latest Mac news. We'll probably move on. I think we've covered this story, although I have a feeling we haven't heard the end of this story. Denise Howell is here from This Week in Law, Bags and Baggage, and the Blogarithms blog on ZDNet. She's an actual attorney. Wow. Also, John Gruber from DaringFireball.net, Andy Anatko from the Chicago Sun-Times, Alex Lindsay from Zimbabwe, and the Pixel Core. We're getting a good picture and good sound from Zimbabwe. Where are you?
I'm at the Solution Center, which is the Apple reseller here in Zimbabwe. So this was he's got a fairly good connection. And yeah. Although I have to admit, the connection in my hotel has been really good. I just wasn't sure if during the day it's not as good.
Right.
At night I was getting 350K a second, which is better than the Hilton in Las Vegas. So
during a conference,
not that I'm bitter. So
that's gonna be.
So anyway,
this is gonna be the best trip ever for you, because now you have like the item one on every single comment card of every single hotel you ever check into for the rest of your life. I was in Zimbabwe, and that was
I was in Zimbabwe. The was 10 times faster.
Better than this Chicago hotel. Thank you very much.
Well, we're glad we had. So, yeah. We thought we wouldn't get you. We're glad we could get you from Zimbabwe. What time is it in? Are you in Harare? Where are you?
Oh, it's not too late. Yeah, I'm in Harare. I'm here for the Harare International Festival for the Arts, and it's 9 p.m. It's not really late. We're about 9 hours ahead.
Glad we could have you here. Before we go much further with this great panel and this great show, we're going to talk a little bit about Citrix, the folks who do GoToMeeting, GoToMyPC, the Citrix remote access tools you use in the Windows professional environment. They've got a new product, brand new, just came out last month, that a lot of us who help teach people how to use things will find very, very valuable. It's called GoToTraining. It's the latest and greatest e-learning tool from Citrix. It allows up to 200 people at once connect to your training session right from their desktops in real time. You can actually save it. You can record it and have them do it on demand as well later. Tests, polls, chat, feedback, all available. You can pass presenter control from one computer to another, so you can have multiple presenters in multiple locales. The recording is really handy, but even more than that, you can upload documents of any kind to a training library, a curriculum, so that your trainees can read ahead before the training begins or afterwards. Customizing the tests is easy. You can send out email invitations with a click of the mouse to all of your participants. Really, I could go on and on. This thing is really fantastic. I love the polling feature. A great way to keep your trainees involved, excited, and paying attention. If you're an IT manager, you might want to bring up GoToTraining at your next staff meeting. If you're if you've attended a training session recently and you thought they could be better, drop a line to the trainer and tell them about 30 days free of GoToTraining. If you're a trainer, test drive GoToTraining free. Just go to GoToTraining.com, GoToTraining.com. 30 days free. Simple to install, simple to use, and your trainees are going to love it. GoToTraining.com. You mentioned the floppy disk. Sony has announced it stopped making them last year. It's going to stop selling them next year, which shows you that you can stop making something and then 2 years later still be selling it. It shows you there's not a lot of demand for it. The end of the floppy. This is also, I saw a really good article from Macworld, the 25th anniversary of the LaserWriter. Ben Edwards wrote a great kind of reminiscence about the first LaserWriter. I remember my friend Tom Santos, who later started the Mac Adam store in San Francisco, had one of the very first LaserWriters. They were $6,000 at the time. He had a Mac, I guess it was a Mac Plus, and a LaserWriter in a van, and he was going around doing portable desktop publishing for people. He'd drive up and park out front and do desktop publishing. It was a breakthrough in 1985, the first laser. Did any of you ever have a LaserWriter? You guys are all so young.
No, I actually bought Don Lancaster's like really great PostScript books because he was promoting it as a computer, and at the time it was Apple's most expensive and most powerful computer.
I guess that's true if you spoke PostScript.
Right, right. And so I was in college when it first came out and it first appeared in a lab. And as I was told by the administrator, job number one of the person who administrates this lab is prevent like stupid like college students from printing like 1,000 sheets of their own letterhead on it. It's like, okay. In big, big bold letters, it says that any page over 20 pages you print on this will be billed to your student account at $20 per page.
Yeah.
That had to happen because it's like, you know what? There's a reason why nobody on the campus can print to the printer. That's because, you know, and of course the guy's name, the guy's address, the guy's phone number has to go over and over and over again. It was a miraculous thing. You can't really accept what a miraculous thing it was to be able to print at this kind of resolution. And
it's beautiful. 300 dots per inch. Set the $7,000 it cost, according to Ben Edwards, would be about $15,000 in modern dollars. Mm-hmm. That just to give you an idea. I mean, this thing was expensive. It was really expensive. I have a friend, a fairly well-known person, and listens to me.
Magical, though. It was magical.
It was what? Magical. It was.
Yeah.
I have a friend who...
Sorry, I'm a little behind.
Yeah, you are. You're getting a little latency. That's all right. Just answer the question before I ask it, and I think we'll all be fine. Two.
Yes.
Three,
no.
Four.
In fact.
Perfect. It's a typical Mac Break Weekly. This guy was looking on eBay and noticed how much iPads were going for, and then he noticed how much old Lisas were going for. He went in his garage. He has a vintage Lisa in perfect condition, and he says, I want to sell it, but I need to wipe the hard drive. And does anybody know? I mean, talk about a bizarre problem to have.
Well, I'm trying to think about, first of all, anybody who might have libeled is probably dead by now.
Well, that's true.
Any porn is going to be like 1 bit, like 8 pixels by 16 pixels.
Yeah, I don't think it's porn he's worried about. You're right.
Okay, that's true.
No, he said he did a lot of M&A stuff, and not B&D, M&A. And so he's worried that
they're... That's what they're calling it now on Craigslist.
Private deal details would be on the hard drive still. But I think I'm probably the case that the operating system for the Lisa was on the hard drive as well. So you really kind of want to be judicious about wiping that drive. He wants it to be a working Lisa. So if anybody listening to Mac Break Weekly knows how to solve this person's problem, let me know. I asked on the radio show, nothing. Well, you'd have to have a Twiggy drive. just crazy.
Oh, what are the chances the Twiggy even works now? Yeah,
right. Well, he says it's in pristine shape. That it's he turned it on, it booted immediately. Yeah. It's kind of amazing that the hard drive works. According to AdMob, who's paying attention to these things, Apple's iPhone has nearly half of all global smartphone use. They know that because, of course, they've got statistics on ads. Turns out all the statistics we're getting these days are from companies that serve ads on various platforms. They know more than anybody. For instance, that the iPad is selling really, really well. AdMob's,
how about the statistic that Wired made available?
What was
about
that?
The huge boost in, I think that iPads are now the most traffic-generating device for Wired.com.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting. You know, I read a lot of periodicals on... I was actually very excited because The New Yorker has a digital edition, and then they do this really stupid thing. It's like a PDF, and you can't... Not only does it not work well on the iPad, it doesn't work on anything well. But I did hear a rumor that they're going to be doing a New Yorker application. In fact, most of the Condé publications will be doing applications for the iPad. That seems to be the way to do it, which is too bad. I wish they'd do a web OS kind of a version. You know,
I'm not sure about those AdMob statistics, because that's AdMob is in-app advertising, right?
Right.
I don't know how fair that is to non-iPhone OS devices. You know, like, I know that they sell ads for Android apps, but I'm not sure that we can conclude that Android apps are equally, for lack of a better verb, AdMobbed as iPhone apps. I don't know about that.
I think
the more interesting statistic are the web server statistics. You know, that if you run a web server and look at your logs and see how many hits are coming from these various devices. And they look very, you know, when you look at mobile devices, look overwhelmingly in favor of the iPhone OS devices.
Yeah, yours would, and mine would too. But, you know, I don't know. We'd have to look at, see what Wired and other tech blogs say, right? What about iPad? Do you get a lot of iPad visits, John, during Fireball?
Oh, ton. I forget. I think it's like 8% or something like that now.
Wow. That's really interesting. I wonder when
I just looked at that up. Of the mobile devices accessing Wired.com, in the short time the iPad has been available, it's now 26% of the traffic.
That's amazing. Nobody at this point could gainsay that the iPad hasn't a huge success. And yet there is this, and it seems to me even more strident than ever before, group of Apple haters that are, if anybody says anything positive about the iPad, immediately say, oh, you're a fanboy. Are the Apple haters, John, you would be probably the subject of more of this than any human alive. Are the Apple haters getting worse?
I don't think they're getting worse. I think that the arguments are more or less the same, but it's that they seem to be getting more agitated because Apple is succeeding so well. You know, it's sort of like take the not to, to say whether you don't even have to say whether we agree with them or not, but take like the Tea Party guys in national politics in the U.S., the people who are in this Tea Party movement. I don't think that their positions have changed, you know, in recent years. I think that but they've become more agitated because politicians who they disagree with have you know, taken the White House and Congress. So I think that the people who really, really are just, you know, Apple haters or whatever you want to call them, I think that they're just they're a little bit more vociferous now because Apple is succeeding so well.
Gotta be driving them crazy.
Right. I mean, I just asked on Twitter the other day if anybody could figure out how many Newtons sold in total a decade ago. and the best guess, the Wall Street Journal had a thing in 1998, right around when they canceled the project, that it seemed like the best number that anybody came up with was about 200,000. So that from 1993 to 1998, Apple sold 200,000 of them. They sold 300,000 iPads the first day.
One day.
And which doesn't count the pre-orders for the 3G that didn't ship yet.
Right.
I mean, it's a very different Apple than the Apple of a decade ago. But I think some of the arguments against, you know, their products and the people who enjoy them the most haven't changed.
There was a rumor, very strong rumor, that broke just after we did the show last week that Apple might spend $8 billion of its $32 billion war chest on ARM. ARM is, of course, the fabless chip foundry that designs many chips for many mobile devices, including all the Apple mobile devices. And in fact, the A4 and the iPad is based on an ARM platform, as best we can tell. iSupply actually, and ARM itself, poured some cold water on those reports. iSupply said it doesn't make any sense for Apple to do that. Unless they somehow decided it's a very costly acquisition with very little in the way of true strategic benefits. It would not give Apple's products a competitive edge or differentiating value, mostly because ARM already has deals with all these other companies. He says there would be no visible end market impact seen for 2 years at a minimum. And iSupply's chief executive itself said, Warren East said, "Exciting though this is to have the share price pushed up by these rumors, common sense tells us that our standard business model is an excellent way for technology companies to gain access to our technology. Nobody has to buy the company."
Yeah.
We throw that rumor out the window. I don't usually do rumors on the show. Now it's grabbing me. It's biting me for doing those. How about this one? I wanted to get Victor Kayo on. Andy, you talked about it a little bit. Victor discovered that you can use the camera connector to import audio.
The iPad camera connector, yeah. As my camera connection kit just came in this morning, and so the first thing I wanted to do with it, I first heard about it from Glenn Fleischman's really great piece on Tidbits. And the funny thing is, if you plug in a standard USB audio device, just like this USB Yeti microphone, and launch any application that expects an external recording device, it will actually work just fine through the iPad. So I plugged this in. I loaded up a Recorder Pro, which is my favorite iPhone recorder app. No muss, no fuss. Used it as an audio input device. Used it as an audio output device because I got my headphones plugged into it. Recorded beautiful audio. I posted a couple of sound clips, some music, a ukulele to my website, and also some spoken audio. It worked with this microphone. It worked great with my USB headset. Worked great in Skype. The only thing that I tried that did not work with it was, oddly enough, this is my USB ukulele, and for some reason it did not like this device. I don't know whether it's just that I didn't have the inputs set correctly.
Sounds good.
Yeah. I think that it's going to be mostly limited by the quality of the sound app that you're using.
So it's full wave audio. Do you think it's an oversight by Apple, or it couldn't have been? They must have engineered it in.
I think it also works with USB keyboards. I used my classic iMac keyboard with it. That works just fine, including all that other stuff. Guess where I was doing my tests. I tried a USB mouse. That doesn't work. I tried my USB tablet. That doesn't work. Right.
Okay.
I think it just tells us that when internally the hardware architecture, when it sees, like, realize that the iPad is designed to work with mechanical keyboards. You can buy a mechanical keyboard for it that connects to the dock. The iPhone also can work with external audio. If you plug it into a device, it goes into the dock. I think this basically says that internally the iPad sees those devices as things that are connected up via a USB bus. And for that reason, speculation, of course, the iPad OS has built-in drivers for these universal type devices. If you try to hook up something really clever, like you try to hook up a USB hard drive to it, that's no go. If you try to hook up anything else that's sort of out of the mainstream to it, that's not going to work either. The only other devices that I was able to get to work with it are USB key drives. Quick qualification.
You can't do anything with them, but it'll see it.
Well, yes and no. The whole point of this device is to basically slurp in pictures and video from USB. The way that that happens is that there is a there is basically a simple standard that so long as the device is formatted in exactly the right way and presents itself to the master device in the right way, it will present its it is findable the pictures and video to the master device. So if you were to format this key drive as like a FAT or a FAT32 device, which is what the camera cards are formatted as, and you put a bunch of JPEGs on that key drive, then that those can be slurped into the Pictures app. The big limitation is just simply the idea of, is there software on the iPad that is designed to be able to access that sort of stuff? So again, if you put a video file on there, you will be able to import it into the Pictures app, but you can't do anything else with it. If you were to put a Word file onto that key drive, you would not be able to get it at it with Pages or any other app because it's just not designed to do that. If you were to plug in a USB printer, that also would not work because there's nothing on the – there are no drivers for printers on there, nor are these apps designed to support them. The interesting thing to me, though, and this is what I put up in the blog post, is what if some – there's a pretty emerging market for third-party apps that will allow you to print documents via Wi-Fi shared printing off of the iPad. What if one of these people decided to say, you know what, let's – create an app that has all the printer drivers for Epson, HP, lets you download printer drivers. And so it will give local hardwired copy, a copper wire, USB local printing capabilities to the iPad. I think that even if such a thing were possible, and I don't think it's possible, if such a thing were possible, that would be an easy no from the iPad App Store if they try to get that for approval. I don't think that Apple would try to shut down keeping these USB keyboards and USB microphones from working, because that would probably be a technical can of worms to shut down devices that don't belong to them, but make sure that people can still use approved devices. But I think that that's enjoy what you got while you got it, and don't try to tip the vessel of knowledge too early.
It's good. I mean, it's good news for people who do audio. It's great.
It's very good news. I mean, my big point is that the big deal for me personally for the iPad is that it's supposed to be the computer I take with me when I don't really need to take a real computer with me. And for me, that's a short list of things that are just sort of deal breaker sort of things where I'm gone for 3 days. I have no intention of doing anything, but unfortunately, I got to do a live Skype call. I got to Skype in for podcasts on Monday. So, damn it, that means I really do have to take my MacBook with me. Now, all I got to do is take my headset and I'm good.
Ah, I love that. So, yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
John Gruber, you mentioned that you thought WWDC dates would be announced today or tomorrow. Is that right?
John? Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Are you not saying anything? Are you there? Got real quiet. Can you hear me? Is it me?
I can hear you.
Is it me?
We can hear you. It froze up on me.
Good.
Seconds.
You said something about WWDC dates. Do you know those yet?
Do I know now or do I think I know?
I think you know is fine with me. I'm not picky.
I think I know, but I'm not going to say because I don't want anybody out there listening to go book tickets. And then when I'm wrong, they send me the bill for the airfare.
Okay. So you know nothing?
I believe that an announcement is imminent.
Any day now. And it's relevant.
Any hour.
Why? Yeah, we care because we think that's when the iPhone will be announced or...
Well, there's another reason to care, too, if you know anybody who's a developer, is if it's the case that they're going to announce it very soon and the date is in June or even early June, it's really cutting it close. Like if you perhaps like me, we're online shopping for airfare last night. And
I wonder why.
And looking at dates in early June, it's really a lot more expensive than if,
right.
They'd announced it a month ago.
Wish they could have been a little more... up front.
Right. And for European developers, I think it's even worse. I think it's a lot worse. I think that the with only 5 or 6 weeks or 7 weeks, whatever it might end up being notice, it's really a lot more expensive. So color me shocked that Apple, doesn't really have a ton of respect or consideration for developers that,
Hey, we're making you plenty of money. What do you need?
Right.
What are you complaining about? Here's an interesting app that won't probably ever make it to the App Store, but I sure would like to. Wi-Fi syncing. Like the ability to, say, use a camera or a variety of other things with the the iPad. It would be sure nice to be have Wi-Fi syncing with my iPhone and iPad and other Wi-Fi, iPod Touch, Wi-Fi enabled iPod devices.
So, I emailed the developer of that app. He sent me an email. You know, I guess he's submitted the app, but it hasn't, you know, hasn't gotten an answer yet. He showed me a video, and I emailed him and said, "Is that, you know, are you sure you're not using any private APIs or anything?" He said, "No, it was a lot of work, but you know, as far as he can tell, he you know, he's playing it by the book." I don't know though. That seems like the sort of
serious voodoo.
Yeah, I mean, and it, you know, if the video is even vaguely accurate, it's, you know, it's exactly what everybody has been sort of asking for ever since the iPhone came out. Of why, if my iPhone has Wi-Fi and my Mac has Wi-Fi and my iPhone is here in my local network, why do I have to connect my iPhone by USB to sync?
Right.
But I don't know. That seems like that's the sort of like. Features that are like should be in the system itself are the sort of things that Apple seems to reject apps for.
Well, the developer has 2 points. He's kind of pulling an Opera, saying, "Well, I challenge you."
Right.
Look, I did it. I challenge you to say okay, and if not, the other point he's making is you can do this. Why didn't you do it?
I'll be first in line to buy it. It looks amazing.
Hell's yeah! Especially on an iPad, it'd be very nice to have wireless syncing on an iPad.
Ah, but it forgoes the iTunes.
No, it syncs to iTunes.
Oh, it does? It's
using iTunes, I think.
Yeah, I think you install something on your Mac, too, that is sort of like the listening device. And then the software that's running on your Mac talks to iTunes locally on the Mac, you know, maybe perhaps through AppleScript or something, you know, the scripting interface or something like that.
As you can see in this video, it suddenly Ross's French iPod shows up on the iTunes and is syncing. Unless this is one of those, you know, David Blaine videos.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seems too good to be true. I don't know.
But when you're putting your iPhone in its little cradle to sync in front of your computer, you have to look at iTunes and maybe buy a song while you're there.
Could be. Could be. And, of course, a lot of what Apple does... you know, this is something, by the way, Microsoft's done in its Zune and will do in its Canon, probably will do in Windows Mobile's phones as well. So Microsoft's way ahead on this. But it does look like that it's the kind of thing that Apple might not want to do for some sort of reason having to do with piracy or its agreements with the record companies. They seem to really not like to give you too much access to what's going on inside those devices, even though hackers love it. I mentioned that the Israelis have lifted the ban on the iPad, but it is still day 8 of the iPad held hostage at Princeton University. Let's see. Jobs says there will not be an app store for desktops as there is an app store for phones. Fernando Valente, developer at Chiaro Software, emailed Steve Jobs, and this is another one of those great Steve Jobs email replies. Remember his last time, I think he said, yep. This time when Jobs was asked about the rumors of a Mac app store, Jobs' answer was, nope.
He's got to be having fun with it at this point.
I think he's, at this point, absolutely. He knows what's going on, right? He knows it's going to come out.
And there's a wonderful style to his emails. There was, I think it was on Metafilter yesterday. If it wasn't Metafilter, maybe it was Hacker News. But one of those sites where it's chock-a-block with comments. But talking about the Gizmodo story, had a fake, you know, obviously fake. You know, the comment was a fake email from Steve Jobs on the situation. You know, it was like, hey, Steve, I'm worried about Jason Chen at Gizmodo. Have you heard about this story? And the answer was, so he gets a lawyer. No big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. That's the one. No big deal.
That was like the one where somebody had to change the name of their app. He's like, right. So you changed the name of your app. No big deal.
No big deal.
Right. So you got a lawyer.
No big deal. Yeah, you're right. I mean, what's great is you hear Steve. I mean, you hear his voice. He's got a voice. Steve, you should write. You've got a voice.
No, I think he's auditioning for the role of the stage manager in Our Town.
Yep.
Because he's a lot folksier. Yep.
Yep. Nope.
Well, gosh.
Yep.
Life is simple here in Cupertino Corners.
Yep.
Why, there's old Jezebel.
Hackers are targeting Windows using iPad owners with a bogus update. This is from Computer World. If you go to your iTunes... It's a Romanian security company, Bitdefender, found this. It's very important to keep the software on your iPad updated for best performance, newer features, and security, the message reads. To get the latest version of iTunes software, please go to and a malicious website and install the application. And the fact that anybody falls for this just proves that Windows users are not so bright.
I've got a Nigerian oil millionaire's trust fund, just tell you. Yeah.
Okay, whatever you say. You get the backdoor Bifroze AADY Trojan, if you should install that. I love this. Bitdefender says, when you have the iPad, you do expect to receive messages. Maybe not email, but messages of some sort from Apple that we have finished an update. You have to get this update. They are clever to do it this way. Mac users are not vulnerable to the attack, even if you go to the bogus iTunes site, because, of course, the Trojan only runs on Windows. Facebook, I think this is a victory for Apple. Facebook has changed the way its video works on the site. It now is iPad and iPhone compatible because it no longer uses Flash. They're doing an HTML5 playback.
Oh God! You see, this is why like it's so frustrating to find out when is Apple being arrogant and stupid and self-delusional, and when do they simply know how powerful they are? Because like you start with the idea of yes, but you're not supporting Flash. Of course, we don't need Flash. Yes, but every single site on the planet uses Flash to serve video. Well, they'll change after we really start our vice. You're an idiot! It's like, no, you're not. YouTube changed. Facebook changed. Everyone else is changing. CBS changed. Okay, we're sorry.
Hulu, change. Hulu is apparently going to do a $9 a month iPad subscription app that'll let you watch Hulu content on the iPad.
See, I want to see where they put the border between pay and free content. What I've been reading says that if you want to see recent episodes, that's still free. If you want to go deeper into the catalog, then that's what comes under the $9 a month subscription fee. And I'm not sure if they have to have some sort of a happy medium between the two, because I use Hulu just to catch up on something that I might have missed last week because I was traveling. I'm not sure that I want to see an episode of House from earlier in the season from 4 or 5 months ago on my iPad.
So. Well, that might change, though. I think there are a lot of people who are looking at replacing cable with some sort of a la carte system. And if the more stuff you can get a la carte or for $10 a month instead of $100 a month.
But that's the more interesting point, because a lot of people take a certain amount of pleasure from, we're sticking it to the cable companies. I'm not spending $60 a month for their stupid package. I'm just going to spend $14 a month for Netflix and $10 a month for Hulu and $8 a month for... And then, you can get really $10 a month to death with all these different services that you're subscribing to. And, I mean, my usual default position is if you want more than $3 a month from you, I got to wait 3 months before I've proved to myself that your service is worth it.
Mm-hmm. Let me clarify this. The CNET article says the iPad was not banned at Cornell, George Washington, or Princeton University. They quote Princeton's chief information officer at the IT office, saying there has not been a ban on the iPad. There are several iPads on campus, even as we speak. And the number continues to grow every day. When the first iPads arrived, we saw there were some problems with them on the campus network. We talked about that last week, the DHCP lease flaw, which is an actual flaw in the way the DHCP is done on the iPad. When our networking staff saw a problem, they put a temporary network block on the device, not on all iPads, just on that iPad, as they do with all devices that are not functioning correctly. As soon as a user has addressed the issue... Okay, this is a little bit, if you'll forgive me, Denise, lawyerly. As soon as a user has addressed the issue, the device is immediately allowed back on the network, and that's what's happening with the iPad. Of course, how are you going to address the issue if you can't patch the iPad? The fix, the temporary workaround, is to never let it sleep.
Oh, that's wonderful. Burn out its hard drive.
We're not,
whatever it has on it.
We're not banning the iPad. You just can never let it sleep.
That's the plot to about half the horror movies ever made.
Yeah, it is. Don't. It's Freddy Krueger all over again.
Right. Yeah, it's a Nightmare on Elm Street.
Don't go to sleep, iPad. They'll ban you. Steve Jobs, according to Gawker's ValleyWag, there is a rumor that Steve Jobs has tentatively agreed to appear on stage at Wall Street Journal's D conference for June 1st through the 3rd. Check your plane tickets there, Mr. Gruber. June 1st through the 3rd. It's in Rancho Palos Verdes down in Southern California near Santa Barbara.
I saw Steve Jobs at the first D conference. Did any of you guys go to that?
Wasn't he there with Bill Gates?
He was.
That was an amazing. I didn't go to it, but I saw it on video. Amazing conversation.
I live blogged it at the time. He said, "We'll never do a tablet."
it's an iPad. It's not a tablet.
Ah, okay.
People don't read anymore either.
Yeah, right. People don't read.
Have you seen our iBookstore?
They'll never watch video on a small screen. Yeah. We should make a collection of those. Mm-hmm. Well, what's become apparent is that when Steve says never, your ears should perk up. That probably means they're working on something, right? Mm. Never is a interesting word in his vocabulary. So you tweeted, John, at midnight this morning, Eastern time, 9 p.m. last night, that the WWDC announcement would be soon. So we're just waiting.
That's not exactly what I said.
Isn't it amazing the power of the tweet?
It is. It's actually very. It's surprising to me. It's because it's so immediate. It's actually. I think there's still four more people who read my website than who follow me on Twitter. But the immediate reaction of putting something on Twitter is more palpable.
Boom. Did anybody read Dan Lyons? I know you don't read Dan Lyons, but anybody read Dan Lyons' Newsweek column, "Fortress Apple: The Company Needs to Open Up."
Yes, I was reminded of the Mac World column that I published not 2 months ago on that very topic.
So it's basically inveighing against the walled garden of the iPad, yeah. And that
it's starting to get really, really old. I mean, this isn't going to be the first time that their secrecy kind of bites them in the butt. I hope that they're going to look to the iPhone thing and the fact that iPad apps aren't being released as quickly as would be good as an indication that maybe they need to revisit the idea of how closely they hold these secrets. I'm kind of concerned about Apple squandering their time lead on the iPad because. Right. All these other companies are going to be coming out with their own slates that have USB ports, that have cameras, that are going to cost $100 to $150 less. That Apple had about a 3-month leap on all of these devices, and that's time that they need to make sure that app store is stocked with every single application that any potential iPad user and any potential user of any other slate is going to want to see. And we're still not seeing it. There are whole categories of apps that are just, there's one or two token little apps, neither of which are very, very impressive. And we're still waiting for the summer for the real volley of apps to come out. Now that developers have their hands on actual hardware starting in April, and they're probably going to be going through a 2-3-4 month development cycle before these really muscular apps start hitting the App Store. So
here's what Lyons says, which does echo what you said, Andy. He says, Apple is reinventing the personal computer, supplanting the current way of doing things with a business model in which Apple controls everything and everyone, customers, developers, advertisers. Never in the history of computing has there been a device over which one company has exerted so much control. We've seen this movie before. A quarter century ago, Apple got a jump on everyone else when it introduced the Macintosh computer in 1984, another gorgeous product. Microsoft didn't have a credible alternative till 1990 when it introduced Windows 3, and it really caught up 5 years later with Windows 95. By then, Apple was toast. The reason? The guys at Apple were control freaks. The guys at Microsoft were more open and left more money on the table for others. I don't know if I agree with that.
I think that's hugely oversimplified look at things.
Go ahead. Let's start with...
I think one of the things that they missed, though, was...
You...
Sorry. Is that me? Oops. So one of the things I think that they missed, though, is Steve Jobs wasn't there. And I do think that makes a difference. And I think that's a liability for Apple in the long term. But I think that, you know, when Apple lost a lot of its ground there, when it was ahead, Steve Jobs was there and literally it just drifted. I mean, I really feel like Apple drifted on momentum for 10 years and just almost stopped because of that. I don't think that they were particularly, you know, they didn't do anything particularly new or they had a lot of stuff that they put out, but it was so confusing by 1994, 1995. I couldn't figure out what Mac to buy because there were 8 of them that did almost exactly the same thing. It's the same way that the camera market is now. You go to a Sony, they've got 6 cameras that almost are identical to each other. And so, the thing is, I think that Steve brought a lot of focus to the company. I think it's very hard to compete with with Apple when they have a decisive leader who's doing something very, you know, moving down the path very, very quickly. And I don't think that's what existed in the past. So when people look at that past, I think that's a big piece that they have to, you know, keep in mind.
Apple stopped innovating. That's why Microsoft caught up, very simply.
I also think that the analogies to the 80s and the Mac are so tortured that I really don't think that they're applicable. I think that, like what Alex just said, that Jobs wasn't there. Start with that. That's a huge thing. But I think it's also important to remember that the audience is totally different. In the 80s, computers were for geeks. I mean, it's just the way it is. And I wanted one. I mean, I was insane, obsessed with them. But normal people didn't really have them. My parents certainly saw no need to have a computer. Now they couldn't live without it. The difference was, you know, when computers became connected to the internet and they became communication devices. Yes. Communication is universal.
Yes.
So pre-communication, pre-internet, computers were, the audience was just totally different. And so it's way more of a consumer type thing now. And I think that works in Apple's favor. I think Andy's argument is far more convincing about what is Apple too closed about. It's that their policies are scaring off developers from investing in pouring insane amounts of effort and time into creating iPhone OS apps, whether it's for the phone or for the iPad, because they don't want to bet their whole company on an app that could be rejected and not get a good answer for it.
Well, that's easily solved. Just be more transparent in your process from Apple. I mean, that would solve that. And certainly there's so much money to be made in this ecosystem that a lot of developers, Alex Lindsay is a good example, choose to take the chance anyway.
Oh, definitely. But I still think that there's a loss.
Go ahead, Alex.
Sorry, we're dealing with this lag. The issue is that there's a lot, all the applications that we're working on. I mean, we're in the kind of the planning phases of a bunch of applications that are related to our industry. I don't have any question about whether they are going to be accepted. I have a question about whether we can get them done to the level that we're trying to get them done at in time and before everybody else and everything else. But I'm not here worrying about, is Apple going to turn down my film, related applications. You know, it just doesn't make any sense for me to worry about that. And I think that 99% of the apps that people think about, I just don't think that there's really that a real worry for that, or they shouldn't be. I think that when you start getting near the edge of things that you think are cool, yeah, that's going to be a dangerous place to go. But there's an awful lot of land out there.
All right, we're going to take a break, come back with your picks of the week. And John and Denise, you may participate as you choose. We like to pick a piece of hardware or software that we think is either overlooked or new that people might be interested in. We'll do that in a minute. But of course, we start our picks with Audible.com, our book picks of the week. Audible is that great online bookstore I've talked about so many times before. 75,000, that's the latest number, updated number of books in the Audible bookstore. Books, performances, comedy, old time radio, there's a ton of stuff there. I mean, if you like listening, we know you do, you're listening to this show. We think you ought to try audible.com. Go take a look. AUDIBLE, audible.com. And if you go to audible.com/MacBreak, you could sign up for the gold account. You'll get your first book free, and it's yours to keep forever, even if you decide to cancel at any time. So your first book is free at audible.com. And I always like to give Andy a chance to recommend an Audible book to us, and I'm not going to do anything differently today. Andy, okay. What do you like? What are you listening to these days?
Well, I'm queuing up books for next week's cruise.
Where are you going next week? Are you doing that Bermuda cruise? Is that next week?
I have a work-related trip. I'm giving a series of talks. Yes, I suppose technically these occur on a cruise ship that's going to the Bahamas.
Not your fault, man.
But you know what? I'm focused on the audience. I'm focusing on the presentation. You know, it could be in the middle of a war zone for all I know. Okay, I'm just there to talk about technology.
That's how much you care.
And if I'm going to be snorkeling for a day and spending 2 days on a beach, well, I don't see how that's relevant. And I'm kind of offended you'd even ask.
Well, I'm going on. You're going to Mac Mania 10 to Bermuda. I'm going on Mac Mania 11 in February to Patagonia.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. It's like,
what? What?
I don't,
what?
I'm saying that, you know, I'm going to the Bahamas for a week. You're going to Antarctica.
Yeah, well, you could come. Well, you could come. Come on. Everybody's invited.
I'm saying, you know, again, beach. I live in New England, man. I'm used to Antarctica, like many weeks out of the year.
Okay. Sal Segoyan will be on there with us, by the way, which will be a lot of fun. Don McAllister. And then I have to point out that the Mac Mania 12 is already in the works. And that's not till September of 2011. And that one is down the coast of California. Starts in Vancouver, goes to Victoria, goes down to San Diego. But it's like 10 days. I guess they're taking their time. They're meandering. And that's a celebrity cruise. So there are some good... You missed... I think it's too late for the Bermuda cruise.
I don't know.
I'm sure it's sold out by now. So what are you going to take to read on the Bermuda cruise?
Yeah, I'm lining up a couple of books. The one that really got my... I saved up like 2 credits for this trip. One of them is Gene Wilder's autobiography, his memoir that he published just a few years ago. It's called Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art. And it has 2 things to recommend for it. But when I'm choosing an audiobook of a book that I haven't actually read yet, obviously I look for reviews. And this was really very nicely reviewed by just about everybody. The New York Times had Janet Maslin... the movie reviewer talk about it and communicates that he's a good author, has a lot of good stories to tell. But I just like his voice.
Yeah.
I just like the idea that for 6 hours and 36 minutes, I'm going to be listening to Gene Wilder speak to me in Gene Wilder's voice.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed to say that I found this book because of that AT&T commercial that uses his pure imagination from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And after not being able to find that track available for download on our iTunes, I was looking around for it and said, oh, Gene Wilder saying, okay, that's good enough. Okay, I just want this nice voice to talk to me and tell me a story for 6 hours.
Can I play a little bit of him just so people hear?
Yes, absolutely.
This is Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art.
House that night, all laughing their heads off at some Weisenheimer who was hypnotizing one of the girls. I thought he was pretty stupid, but I enjoyed watching the cocky little faker who thought he knew how to hypnotize people because he'd read his uncle's book on hypnosis.
I like it. You don't hear Weisenheimer in much modern literature these days, so I think that's great. That by itself is enough to recommend this book.
In and of itself. So, yeah. So they're not. That doesn't work with all celebrity voices. I mean, Rita Rudner, maybe not. Mm. But this works. I think it's going to work really, really great.
Good. All right. Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art, Gene Wilder's latest, but that's just one of 75,000 titles. You get to browse and pick almost any book free. Some books, because they're extra long, are 2 credits, but most books are 1 credit. You get 1 credit if you sign up for the Gold account. And I think, by the way, some of Gene Wilder's other stuff is on here as well. There's quite a bit of Gene Wilder on here. I didn't realize he'd written a number of books.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Audible.com/MacBreak. We love them. We know you'll love them too. Give them a try, and we thank them so much for their support of Mac Break Weekly. Let's go clockwise, starting with Alex Lindsay and your pick of the week, sir.
So there's an update to one of my favorite applications, and it just gives me an opportunity to tell people how much I love it, which is Transmit. So have you guys seen the new? There's a new Transmit for.
Yes.
I just love Transmit. I use it every day for something, and. Just constantly up to downloading. I just feel like they have the interface and the workflow and everything else, just really figured out. They've got a new interface. They've improved it. And they also, it's kind of a setup. I don't really use Amazon S3 but all that stuff's kind of very much right on the top as little buttons that you can just kind of click. So FTP, SFTP, S3, WebDAV. One of the cool things that you can do now that you couldn't do before is you can actually install a fuse onto your laptop, onto your computer. And what I now have is I have my Dropbox, the application. We did this a long time ago. So it's Dropbox. It now looks like a hard drive. It looks like a hard drive for my applications. It looks like a hard drive on my desktop, and I can open it like a hard drive, and I can save stuff to it, and I can pull stuff out of it. And what I'm accessing is actually my FTP. So I don't have to, when I have that set up, once it's mounted,
I can, you know, it's just there. And so a lot of times when I'm on, I want to log in or anything else, I don't need to log in at all. I can just simply drag stuff, you know, drag stuff into there and send it up like you would, I guess, you know, an iDisk or whatever. But all of that stuff is now built into your FTP access, and it can be set up for your FTP, SFTP, S3. So if you want to send files there, now they've done a bunch of other things that I haven't tested yet, which is to, you know, they've evidently sped up putting up lots and lots of files. Yeah, it's, and it's, I don't know how much it is now, but whatever it is, it's worth it. It's like $20 or $30 or, and it is a, this is just a, an application that if you do any kind of FTP stuff, this is the application to own as far as I'm concerned. I just don't think that there's any close second. And so, and most importantly, the truck, the new truck is really,
it's a nice truck. It's a good truck.
So anyway.
Yeah, John, you've been beta testing this, I know, for a while. I saw on your blog.
It's really good. Oh, and the other thing I would just point out is that the product page itself on the Panic website is itself an amazing work of art. It's a fantastic product page. So you scroll down, you scrolled past it. There's a screenshot of the interface with these little red dots. You hover mouse over the little red dots, and they have red status. Once you've hovered over them, they turn brown, so you know which ones you've already explored.
Wow.
So it's like a visual indication of the new user interface. You hover your mouse over an element. Hey, what's this? It tells you what it is, and then it marks it as red. It's amazing. They should sell that. They should sell that to other Mac developers.
That's really sweet. These guys, Panic is an amazing company. They really are just doing great stuff.
And I think it's so great. Yeah, they focus on such, you know, what mostly would be just basic products, but then they bring so much creativity to something, you know, that is something that's just a basic use, and they do it so well.
Well, it's true, because I used for a long time Fetch. You know, we've all used, you know, crazy simple Mac FTP programs. In fact, the Macintosh comes with a command line FTP program, and there's
that's historically been the problem. I mean, all the FTP apps that I was using before Transmit is that someone took an open source or command line FTP, slapped on the most simple bare bones Mac, vaguely Mac like interface onto it. This is the only FTP app I've used that really feels like it was built like a Mac app from the ground up. Love it, love it, love it.
Yeah. Well, it's $19 to upgrade if you're a Transmit 3 owner, which I am. So I'm gonna
bastards. I take all that back. $20 for an upgrade.
$20, why I oughta?
When there's a command line for free, oh, they're high. They're high. They're high.
And if you've been foolish enough to be not using Transmit and you want to get it, it's $34 for a new license. How about you, Mr. Andy and Not Co? What do you like today?
I like today a simple app called iClock from Plum Amazing. It's a type of app that you don't see much anymore, where all these guys did was think, what features are for calendaring and time are built into the Mac? That, great. Okay, so let's now add every other feature we can possibly add. So if it has to do with dates and times, this app will let you do it. If you want an enhanced version of the clock in the menu bar, it'll give you that. If you want to have reflect multiple time zones so that if you're doing business in like multiple cities and you need to know, okay, I've got three columns due, one to an editor in London, one to an editor in Chicago, and one to an editor in San Francisco. Which one of them is going to call and annoy me first? Okay, so I better write the London column first. You know, maintaining multiple time zones and stuff like that. Maintaining multiple alarms for things. So you get reminded of a project that's going to be due in like 28 days or 27 days or something you need to start preparing for. A simple like floating palette view of your iCal so that you just need to get a quick eyeball on. Someone has asked me if I'm going to be available on the 4th. Can I quickly say yes or no? I need to know if I'm available that day or not. It'll give you that. It'll give you to-dos. It'll give you desktop clocks. It'll give you lists of uptime on various apps that you're using. I could spend the next 20 minutes just going over feature by feature. I do like elegance in an app. What I like about Transmit is that it hides most of its feature. It hides most of its power from you in the idea of making sure that's just focused on the one task of moving a file from one place to another. What's good about iClock is kind of in the opposite. It just tries to see how many features can we add. And it's not as complicated as I'm making it sound, but they would never do the Apple sort of thing of saying, well,
you know, yes, it would be nice to have a sort of a quick click to get a 45-second timer on the screen, but how does that work into our idiom? No, they say, their thinking is, no, that would be very useful to simply pull down a menu and simply say, give me right now a 5-minute countdown clock so I know when I need to end this phone conversation. Well, that's a good feature. Let's add it, and we'll do it that way.
It does look like it has everything but the kitchen sink in here.
I mean, exactly. And it's less complicated than I'm making it sound. It's probably even less complicated than the website might make it look. If you can include the features that you want and leave behind the features that you don't want. Suffice to say that it's a $30 download. You can try it for free. But I think that most people will get their $30 out of it by the time they've had it up and running for 2 or 3 weeks.
This is wild. You can see how long your applications have been running. You can see the phases of the moon. Right. You can see Apple's stock price.
Exactly.
Just anything. If you could put it in a menu, they've done
217 days till Christmas.
It's from plumamazing.com, iClock.
And just recently updated to 1.1 last month. They added some really nice little tricks to it, so definitely worth a mention.
Cool. Great choice. Denise, did you want to partake?
I do. Mine's free, actually.
Love that.
It's an app for the iPad. It's called SkyGrid.
Oh, use it. I really think this is interesting.
I do, too. I like it a lot because it is, you know, a way of consuming news on the iPad, but it is focused on what people are talking about right now. And it pulls in from all sorts of sources. You get tweets, individual tweets sometimes. You get mainstream media. And it's only on version 1.1. So I excuse the fact that from time to time I get sites that look like they may have been loosely translated from another language and have little to do with the topic that they're supposed to be on. That only happens occasionally. Usually it's really, really good information. It's free and it's very current.
So it's kind of, it's not exactly a newsreader, but it's like a newsreader. And I don't know what the algorithm is for figuring out what the hot topics are, but
a little bit like tech meme, you know, it's trying to surface a buzzworthy kind of story. Although, as you say, I have no idea what the algorithm is that they're using. But I like the idea and I definitely use it all the time. So it's addicting.
And some wild categories. I mean, here's boxing. So here's the hot stories in boxing. You know, I'm not sure why that's there. I confess I check celebrity a little more than I ought to. I find that it's just keeping me up on what Miley Cyrus is up to these days. And and I don't know. You know, how's Jesse James doing? You know, he's kind of had some hard times. Lindsay Lohan to get a visit from Child Protection. Oh, my God. So
I could put down the iPad.
Okay. I'm not going to.
There's a whole iPad category too. If you just want to follow things,
yeah,
iPad.
Yeah, it's. It's funny. I found the same thing. I'm always looking for news applications, and I just found this really kind of surprisingly compelling.
Yeah, I mean, you might want to complain that you can't put your own feeds into it, but I actually think that's more of a feature than a bug. I like sort of having them surface what's topical at that time.
And I have some good news readers. You know, I talked about NewsRack last week. I can always look at my own feeds, but it's kind of interesting to see what's going on, you know, according to others.
Right.
SkyGrid. Mr. Gruber, you have a pick for us?
I'm going to go with a pick that I am almost certainly going to guess has been picked before, but brand new iPad version. It's an app called Simple Note.
Oh, yes.
It has existed for the iPhone for a long time, over a year, and I have long sung its praises. And now, just I think yesterday, they came out with a free update, but the app itself is free. You can download the app for free in the App Store. It's a universal app, one app that runs natively on both the iPhone and the iPad. The iPad interface, this is a notes app. Here's the premise. Make a notes app that looks just like the nice, simple mail client for the iPad that uses Helvetica everywhere, just a white background, no nonsense about, you know, paper notepads or 3D effects. It's just a column of notes on the left, plain text notes on the right. And the killer feature is that it syncs to a web service that the developers who made it wrote using Google App Engine. And so your notes sync between your iPhone, your iPad, and there are a couple of Mac clients. They have an API They don't have a simple note app for the Mac, but there's apps like Notational Velocity, which is free, that sync to the Simple Note API. And there is a web app that works on any computer, Mac or Windows, whatever. So your little plain text notes, you jot something down on one machine, you go to another, you open it on your iPad, and there it is. And the iPad app is just, it's exactly what you think it would be. It's great.
You know, I think it wasn't really a pick. Merlin Mann talked about using it and Notational Velocity together. And I've had Simple Note on here as just a great way to get text into my iPhone so I could type on my desktop and then get the text in. But now
it's great. I mean, I do that all the time. If I have anything I want to quick, I got to get to the airport. Here's to take it with me in case I need to reprint my boarding pass. Here's my confirmation number. Copy it from this. Just go to Notational Velocity on my Mac. Paste it. Just go. Just leave. I don't have to connect. I don't have to sync. No USB nonsense. Just go. And when I open my iPhone and open Simple Note, there it is. There's the note I just pasted in. It's super reliable. And it's free. I mean, I cannot recommend it highly enough.
$8.99 if you want to pay for the premium account that gets rid of ads and stuff on the website and so forth. But yeah, you can use it all its functionality.
Which is a bargain. It is.
I pay for it.
Yeah. I would pay twice that. It's easy.
Because I use Evernote, which does all these same things for free, and I'm just curious Evernote's more complicated, or why you prefer this over Evernote? Say,
I Evernote is great. I know people sing, but I think it's just a very different approach to it. Simple Note is super, super focused. Evernote has images and all sorts of other things. Does OCR? This is just one list, no folders, no hierarchy, no tagging. Just a list of plain text notes.
Yep.
And it just couldn't be, as a guy who carries a physical paper notebook everywhere, just to have something. So if I want to jot something down, it's there. It's, it's the closest digital analog to just super, super simple.
And
you never have to think.
And you'll want to get the desktop app as well so that you can sync up via Wi-Fi. Yeah, great way to get notes into and out of the iPad. I have an iPad pick as well. Thank you, John. I have an iPad pick as well. This is actually, I have several. I've been having fun with music applications on the iPad. And actually, I know that this is kind of a little bit in your realm, Alex Lindsay, because you're the ones who keep bringing in all those looping things. But I'm amazed at the variety and quality of apps for music on the iPad. And this big interface really is great. Did I talk about Looptastic last week? I can't remember. I don't know if I did.
I think you might have mentioned it. I don't think we really got into it in any detail.
Really a great little program to make loops. I should turn it up if I'm going to do this. And mix them. You download a whole bunch of loops. You can make your own. It records your own loops and insert them. It has some fun little toys like this flanger that allows you to kind of modify the sound on a thumb pad or a glitchy repeater. So you can give it that rap sound. It has loops in dub, in reggae, in hip-hop, in trance, in electronica. And you can mix and match. You can take an air horn from the reggae and put it into your trance loop for a really exciting effect. Just watch those dancers jump every time that horn goes off. So that's Looptastic HD. I really like it. I think it's $10. There are a number of other synth apps, if you're a synth fan, like this Korg iElectribe, if you've used a Korg synthesizer, it'll look really familiar to you. I am not a synthesizer wizard, but I have to say,
it's so much fun.
It's just fun. Yeah. And finally, here's one that I think even if you're not a synthesizer lover, you really ought to have. It's called Cat Piano. You have a variety of different cat sounds, everything from angelic kitty to asthmatic kitty.
Thinking about all the apps that got rejected by the App Store.
Come on, this is better than...
my kid is going to love that one.
This is better than farting. I wouldn't give it to your kid unless you really have a high... I actually drove my wife out of bed this morning.
Furious cat. I love it.
And it got my dog really interested. Although, I have to confess, unfortunately, the cat just paid no attention to it. So that's Cat Piano. That's absolutely free, and it does have actually a grand piano with some pretty good piano sounds in it. And you can share your...
And you can record your books. And you can record,
them and share your cat creation with others via email.
So it's the social media app.
Actually, I don't think you can. You can just tell
them
about...
that venture capital money.
I don't think you can actually record it. It just plays it. And probably that's a good thing. Okay, so there you go. There's my latest creation.
I didn't want to screw it up, but is this the first Mac Break Weekly where nobody picked anything that was more than $35?
There's
like a single like $40,000 something or $10,000 plugin.
It's not too late.
Holy cow.
Actually, you know what my pick was going to be, and I probably should mention it. Rhapsody has been updated for the iPad and now allows you... I wasn't really listening to this song. I don't know why it's starting. It now allows you to cache your songs on here. It's $10 a month for unlimited. It brought subscription music to the iPhone some time ago. They've improved it. They've made it iPad. Actually, this is not iPad specific. It's still an iPhone app, but it works great on the iPad, and you can listen to music kind of unlimitedly on it. And I have to say, I like Rhapsody, so that's another choice for you if you can stand the fact that they used to be real networks. All right. We have gone long once again, but there was so much good stuff to talk about, and we had such a great panel. I think it was well worth it. Denise Howell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
This Week in Law, TWiL, is heard on the TWiT network. You can find out more about it or download it at twit.tv/TWiL. But I think the best thing to do would be to watch TWiL live. You do it Fridays, right?
Fridays, 11 o'clock.
11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv. And I imagine that you've been talking a little bit about this phone thing.
Oh, yes. This Friday, we're going to have our Washington Bureau come on the show. Two guys from Public Knowledge are going to join us. So we'll talk more about the fact that we don't have a federal shield law and other stuff, I'm sure, related to what we talked about earlier today.
Really a good show. This Week in Law, twit.tv/TWiL. It's on iTunes, the Zune store, everywhere else too. Thank you, Denise.
Thanks,
I really appreciate
getting
some gravitas into this conversation. Speaking of gravitas, we're glad John Gruber was here from daringfireball.net. Always a pleasure. Always great to have you on. A must-read blog for Apple interested parties. I won't say fanboys. For anybody who cares about Apple, daringfireball.net. And of course, thank you for being here. Really do appreciate it. Our regulars, Mr. Andy Yannacco from the Chicago Sun-Times and the Celestial Waste of Bandwidth, CWOB.com. Great to have you back, Andy.
Always a slice.
And from Africa, he made his way from Zimbabwe, from Harare, Africa. Mr. Alex Lindsay is at the PixelCorp.com for that great multimedia guild of professionals making great content. PixelCorp.tv for the podcasts. Are you going to bring anything, any content back from Africa or do anything while you're there?
Oh yeah. So I got my press pass. See, that's what the press pass looks like here. And they made it very clear not to lose the bracelet. Cause if I lose the bracelet, I'm out.
Plus you get unlimited free rides on the carnival, as well.
Exactly. Yes. This is basically like South by Southwest, except it's African. So it's just bands and playing in a whole bunch of different areas, but it's all like in one little area and there's tons of, theater and people from all over the world. It's actually a pretty amazing thing. So I'm going to be shooting a bunch of video and stills. I'm going to put up some of it while I'm doing it at my blog, BorderSack, which is BorderSAC.com. And you'll see a little travel log up there. And it's right now, it's only just me getting there. But over the next couple of weeks, if you go, there's a little travel log at the top there. So I'm going to – that's what it looks like. That's from my hotel room.
You'll see that gorgeous
video there. And so it's a bunch of tents and a bunch of – and there's going to be – there's already – thousands of people there, and it's just a pretty amazing event. So I'll be taking as much video as they'll let me and a bunch of stills, and so I'll bring some of that back. I'll be posting some of it to this blog as I'm doing it. I'm going to be in Africa for the next month, so I'll be posting from here in Zimbabwe, but also in Tanzania, Rwanda.
And you're slowing down. Did you do these panoramas on your iPhone?
Do my meeting there. I'll be hoping.
Did you do these panoramas?
I did it on AutoStitch. I love
AutoStitch. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's all AutoStitch. It's just,
I just thought it would be part of it is just the experience of different airports. And so I thought it was interesting to show, you know, how, because this one you have to take the bus to, you know, to get to the plane. And the woman, you can see her twice. You see her right to the side, and then you see the back of her a little farther over.
Right.
So so anyway, but yeah, having a.
You actually see her three times. Four times. Yeah. Boom, boom,
I
boom.
Take
now, this is what Auto Stitch does. And that's the only thing with Auto Stitch. You get these little ghosties, yeah. But that's fine. That's cool. Thank you, Alex. Enjoy your trip.
We'll look for, thank you.
Everybody should go to bordersac.com and you can follow Alex's virtual travel log. Bordersac, BORDERSAC.com. Thanks, everybody, for being here. We appreciate it. And we will be back next week. Let's hope it's something else besides a stolen iPhone we get to talk about. You can follow this show live every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC at live.twit.tv. Of course, subscribe at twit.tv/MBW. It's on iTunes. It's on the Zoom store. It's everywhere podcasts are. And audio and video. You can also watch video on YouTube. YouTube.com/twit in the Mac Break Weekly channel. I'm Leo Laporte. Thanks for being here. Now get back to work. Break time is over.